1901. Could I ask you first of all, Ernest, to tell me something about your family life before the war started? Where, for instance, were you born?
I was born in Berlin on the 1st of March 1918, and before that I was brought up in a middle-class home in Western Berlin. It had a big flat, which was at that time quite luxurious, 7 rooms, and the building we lived, quite a number of prominent people lived, the general, the retired general, and a very famous composer, and it was a very lively place because people were quite friendly to one another, and I was the youngest of three. My brother was born 10 years earlier, 1908, and my sister was born 1910. But by the time I arrived, I was a sort of little baby. My parents, my mother had already enough already. My father was delighted to have me. And I would say spoiled because everybody was very nice to me, partly because I was very small. And food situation after the First War was very limited. My parents refused to buy on the black market. So we were not very well off in regarding food, which of course I didn't know. And as I grew older, I was still very, very small, normally small, very thin, and they were always very worried about me. And to the annoyance of my sister, I usually got special food when I wanted it, and I didn't like something, and she was very annoyed because when she was young, she never was allowed to do that. She felt I was being spoiled. She probably knew that I was. And I grew up in Berlin, which was very depressed because of the US war, which surprised everybody very much. And of course, they all thought they were living in the war, and suddenly they found out they were incredible war for most people. We were middle class. I don't like the word middle class, but you call it the Jews. And my grandparents had been very wealthy, actually, as I said, millionaires. And we lived under the circumstances better, of course, than most other people. And they were all very concerned about the future, because the future looked literally grey. And I always remember grey, because it reminded me of this place which reminded me very much of Berlin later, many years later, when I saw Glasgow in winter. It was very similar like Berlin, very cold and very dull and very grey. And in Germany, of course, having lost the war, one experience which had a great impact on me right from, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years old, and my mommy took us me out and showed me Berlin and so on. I only saw everywhere cripples sitting on the floor, minus their legs. They didn't have any artificial legs at that period, minus their arm, and sitting there, and I was aware that they looked totally hopeless. So they looked so sad and so depressed, because as a child you don't know what depressed is when there, but you were aware of it because it was sort of a with a terrific impact on me seeing them day in, day out, and I was wondering how they survived. And my secret fear was, when I was a bit older, 5 years, 6 years, that all people, when they grown up, sooner or later will end like this. And I thought too that one day I would be on the street and begging, you see. And I was very serious. My mother always kept it later on to me. She was always surprised how serious I was with you. So, I went first to kindergarten, which was a usual thing to go to, and I was always very, never was very good with anything manual. I was left-handed, and left-handed was at that time something which wasn't right. And as soon as I went to school, to infant school, they tried very hard to teach me that I should use my right hand instead of my left hand, which didn't quite work because I was left-handed. And left hand was an abnormality. In the end, I could neither write with the left hand nor with the right hand. I wrote, of course, but not a very fast and never very sure. And if I would have been trained in my left hand, I think I would have been just like everybody else, but I wasn't. I accepted that. And when I went to school first, this was a change of the school system in Germany, because after the war, we got a republic instead of the emperor. And one of the changes was, before the war, we went immediately to a junior school or a grammar school, which the German gymnasium, similar thing as here, but you started off already with 6 years in that school, and later on when you were 10, then you went into the real grammar school regularly, and called it school either as first language French, or Latin, or English later on. But in the junior school, of course, you learn read and read and write. And at that time, when the public came to the office, and this was abolished. And you could either go start off right away in a private school, or you had to go into a state school where everybody was in. The idea was to influence people more in a democratic way, that they learn people, so-called working class and other places, and they all brought up together. This was building much closer. But I started off because it was a small material, so afraid that I would go into the official school. The children would kill me, I don't know why. And I went immediately in one of these private schools, which were very nice, but totally useless because they had no proper education. And two friends of mine joined me. And after a year, my father decided it was not only a waste of money, but it was a waste of anything. I would never learn anything there. And had me transferred to the state school, where to everybody's surprise, after 6 months, I was still quite alive. Nobody had ever mentioned me. It was very nice to me. So the other two boys, who were still in the private school, shifted over to the same school, you see. That's quite interesting, because these two others, I was with them until I was 10 years in school, I still see regularly in London, you see. One became a professor, another one a dentist. And we're still very friendly with one another. So we went up to school. This school was very interesting, this general school, because our teacher was very young. 29, 30, which was very unusual because the Republic didn't have much money and the father had the old teachers whom they had to pension off, brought them back again and had them teaching and saved new teachers coming in. And I was quite fortunate to have this young teacher who was very dynamic, very handsome. All the mothers were intrigued with him because he was such a nice man, so charming, and he was an officer in the army. He was about to sit now in the late 20s. He was brilliant as a teacher, very nice. But anybody who wasn't really, in his eyes, proper middle class, he didn't use this idiotic word, was treated very nice about him. All the proletarian children were caned and very sadistically treated, which surprised us. We, for his three boys, were sort of couldn't understand that, you see. But he knew to. He knew that we had influence, and the one father was a professor, and the other was a famous lawyer, so he wanted to be in good terms with the parents, you see. And the only thing, because he enjoyed his company, because he was so brilliant and so interesting, and his history is so interesting, which was my favorite subject anyhow, he was always surprised how much I knew about it, because I started, the first thing which I did, when I was 6 or 7, I could read fluently, you see, and started reading it. But with other subjects which I was not interested, I totally ignored, you see. So I couldn't understand that I was obviously not meant a little bit, but I could understand that you could do one and not the others, you see. So it was always very nice to me. So eventually, when I was 10, we were transferred to so called grammar school. Just say the last word about the teacher. One of his pupils, whose father had been an officer in the general staff in the First World War, which had only been 8 years earlier, was of course very, very much expert. They were treated like our teacher because he was very much in order, had a pupil whose father had been in the general staff, you see. And this boy, funnily enough, was very good in school. It was really brilliant. And was this star. And by some circumstance, I'll tell you now, I saw him after I had saw him last time, 1928, when he parted company. I saw him again at my silver wedding when he had discovered where he lived in Berlin and invited him. And I went to our silver wedding in the 70s, you see. And I met him again. He was now a doctor, had been in charge of a hospital in Berlin, but had retired. He'd been in Stalingrad, and he'd been everything, and he had military background, but to my great surprise, by the time I met him again, he was a total pacifist, you see, and was very, very different. That thing, I couldn't get used to it because I had a different image of him. You see, he was very friendly, and I had corresponded with him, telephoned with him until his before he died, since he had a bad heart. But in the return for the teacher, I asked him whether he had ever heard of his teacher again. And he had. And that was very impressive. When the Nazis came to power, he stopped being a teacher and became a senior professor in the SS. Which in a way was symbolic, you see, and he wasn't different surprised either, because he knew him. And he all had noticed that, you see, the point was that he would treat it differently. And he was a person who would have sold his soul to the devil if he saw any advance in it, you see. Mm-hmm. It's quite very clever, very charming, etc. So that was the last thing about it, you see. Mm-hmm.
How about your religion? Were you a religious family?
No, we went. My father never went to a synagogue. He was totally disinterested. His family, he came from Königsberg, which was the eastern part of Germany, and he was about the extent of that day, early in the 40s, when I was born, and I knew particularly, I never knew a great deal, only little bits of his family. All of us found out that they had been very influential in the place where they lived. They had a very large family. I think he had 7 brothers by the time I was born, they were all there. And his brother-in-law was one of the first Jewish officers in the First World War. He was killed in the first month. And my father was quite an enthusiastic soldier, but he was too old to be on the front. And we felt 150% German, and we never felt we were later anything to associate with Judaism. My mother was a little bit, she went down to certain religious holidays to the synagogue. If she wanted to, she could come with me, and I came in with her, and I was very bored, so I didn't go again, and she didn't mind that. And my father took me out for walks. I was 7, 8, he was in the 40s, and the conversation he had with me, in retrospect, was not very ironic, because he had one interest, he was fascinated by it, in the history of the old Germans, ancient Germans, who fought the Romans a very long time ago. And he told me the whole story how the Romans eventually were conquered by the good, so-called Goten, G-O-T-E-N, the Goths, I think that's what it is. And then later on, it was defeated by the Romans and wiped out. And this was, and I saw a book in his library, which I read with great excitement, because it was very well written, called The Struggle for Rome. And I loved that book. And later on in school, I could always shine with this. Nobody knew about this, about the history. I knew it inside out, and the teachers were most amazed that I knew this well. And I find it ironic in retrospect, you see, that he was so felt so much as a German that he never found the irony when my mother was in synagogue and we were now talking about the Germans, because we felt, we were many of them, I mean, I would say the majority of German Jews were like that, we were very, very identified with Germany. The reason for this is very simple, because when the Jews who still lived in a ghetto in Germany in the beginning of the 19th century, they were camped in, they were already quite self-educated to some extent. And when Napoleon started invading Germany and all the other countries to take full power for the rule of the empire, the first thing he did, the Jews were liberated and freed from the ghetto. And from that moment onwards, the Germans were very quite happy with it, they didn't mind that. And the Jews were more assimilated and more accepted in Germany than in any other country in Europe. And they became paradise for Jews, you see. When the World War started and the German army marched into Poland to attack Russia, which they didn't get very far from here, then they had banners and flags where they welcomed the Jews to them, you see, to relieve them from the tyranny of the Poles and the Russians, you see. And the Jews associated Germany with a very democratic and very liberal party. And yes, therefore, once they were free, they immediately blossomed out. And I always give this example. When the Indians came to England 30 years ago, and you went 20 years ago to the public library, professors, lawyers, civil servants, do chemical work, to see what dentists, everything. And now, of course, there are quite a number of them doing very well.
Experience any anti-Semitism? This would be before, of course, 1933, wouldn't it? You know, as you were growing up.
I'll tell you only one point, early story. I guess the first letter you've taken on, I don't know. Are you on it? Yes, this was quite a real story, because I was very small. And some of the bigger boys, I must have attracted them in some ways, I don't know why, were always afraid that somebody might attack me, which nobody ever did. Not because I was a Jew, because he was small, an easy target. So he would always march near me. When anybody could then speak, he would go away, you see, leave the helmet alone. No, they had never any intention, right? And I was quite touched at the 2 years of war, I had nothing, never spoke much to him. And many years later, when the Nazis had come to power, just before I had left Germany, I went to Warsaw, which everybody went as the leading street in Berlin for Kurfürst and Downing, a sort of like Regent Street, you see. And I walked along there, and suddenly I saw two SS people running towards me, with having on their feet Adolf Hitler. This meant they were the bodyguard of Hitler. Towards me, and then I thought, what on earth do you want from me? And when it came near, it was my former bodyguard. So I was most amused that my bodyguard had become Hitler's bodyguard. He was so stupid, he didn't even know that I was Jewish, and was so friendly to me, was so delighted to see me, and I was a little bit reserved, because it was uneasy, it was very embarrassing, you see. And so I was very polite and very kind to him, and was glad when he disappeared again. So I thought it was very amusing, this particular thing. I never had the slightest problem, neither my parents, neither my father, my mother. And therefore, we never took Hitler very seriously, because we thought Hitler was looked a little bit grotesque, really. You see, and what he said, nobody knew, because we couldn't at that time hear much of his speeches, because they were not shown on television or on the radio. You see, we didn't get in the papers what he said, which was rubbish, you see. And we could never understand why people became so enthusiastic about it, but it came much later, of course, you see.
When were you first aware of sort of fascism and the rise of Hitler?
Yes,
you as a young growing up player.
I became aware, can tell you exactly the date, 1928. 1928, I think father was still dying. I looked out of the window and I fled to another room to the street. And there was an endless demonstration of young Nazis in brown uniform carrying their flag. With a cross, and with music and so on. And that was the first time I saw them organized, you see, not walking. And it looked very sinister, and they felt uneasy. But they were at that time a very small party, you see, they weren't taken seriously. But I saw them in the sort of in the flesh. And it was felt at the. I don't know what this is, I wonder whether it's become a series or not. And then, of course, you see, as at that time, 1928, 1929, this was a time when the Wall Street crash occurred in America and the terrible repercussions in Germany. And immediately, for a short time, it had looked as if Germany would recover from the damage, the financial damage during the war. But with this collapse of the banks everywhere, the whole thing became suddenly totally uncertain and was accompanied by a very, very fast number of unemployed people who really were helping the starving, you see. And at that period, of course, people became, particularly the industry, became more and more worried about the future, and felt they always had a fear that the revolution which had taken place in Russia could, through the experience of these months and years, could lead to a communist state. And of course, the Russians had a great interest in it, but I think it was a bit overestimated, because the Russians had so many problems of their own that they might have helped the communists a bit, but only marginally.
How did this affect your family? You know, it's your experience we're interested in. So, with this crash, was that related to your father's death?
Yes. You see, my father had various several businesses. One, he sold large-scale flour to the papers. And another secret which I never quite understood, of course, it was 9 years at the time, and he wouldn't have been asking to explain it to me, of course, children are not so interested in that. He was hooked all half a day at the stock exchange, but not, I don't think, as had any function of the stock exchange. Apparently, in Germany, I don't think, as far as I know, in any other stock exchange, I've never had any other stock exchange, you could, as a private person, if you were of a very good reputation, could attend stock exchange and probably buy directly or something, you know. And he was very involved with stock exchange. And when the crash occurred, he was overnight penniless. You see, he was 55 at that time. And he had, first of all, this was for him a terrible failure of his own planning that it had come to that. And didn't realize that he was just a victim of the circumstances of the time. And many people followed that in America. They jumped from the skyscrapers and so on. And I didn't know that, you see. I came home one day from being with my friends together for the holidays in Auburn. And my mother was at home and with her friend, a good friend of hers. And obviously, I had cried. And she said to me, I just asked you to come into the room. But my father had a stroke and was in hospital. And it was serious and typical for me. I had a teacher at the time who believed in natural medicine and told us non-stop about illnesses and what was happening to this and that. And he had just told me a few weeks earlier, if people have a stroke, it's very important that it's not on the left side because it's where the heart is. On the right side, they have a chance. And I remember asking my mother immediately, where is the stroke? And she was like, taken aback, you see. And I said, is it on the right side? Yes, he said, you see. Or they said to me, will be all right, I said to her. And I didn't know, of course, 2 days later he had died. And that was it. I never knew at the time. I only heard it by chance. 20 years later in England, when I was with some third distant relative together, and they said to me in the course of conversation, this has meant committed suicide like your father. And it was the first time I heard it, you see. Then, of course, overnight, my whole living standard changed totally. We had this very nice, very elegant flat, as I said, which I accepted because I'd never seen another flat when it was nothing special at that time, either good or bad. And my mother did something which later on all people did really with these flats, and I had the same problem. They started subletting the flats, you see, to people. We lived in, instead of 6 rooms, in 2 rooms. And I found it was very exciting because the people who came to us as subletting to flat, so one or another one. One was a count, this is the girlfriend, an Austrian count who lived in Berlin as a representative of the Times. And another one was a lady who was a baroness from Russia as a girlfriend. She was obviously a student, which I didn't know, very nice and very friendly. And the other ones, they friendly and found it much more interesting. Because these people were all very nice to me and explained to me anything I wanted to know, either about Russia or about the political situation. This count looked just like other count of a magazine. He was so real. It was just unbelievable, you see. Just as you imagine count ought to look like. Since I'm honestly a count, he was very nice. He was very democratic, very intelligent. And then eventually he moved out, like this always happens. And the next time I saw him, during the war, when I was in Hyde Park, I bumped into him. And he was very surprised to see me, and I was very surprised to see him. And he worked then for the BBC Psychological Warfare, you see. And after the war, he died. And he invited me first to see him in his bed. Yes. He was very nice to me.
Is that how your mother kept the family together?
Yes.
What had happened to your brother at this time?
My brother, then, of course. My brother.
What was his name?
Gerhard. G-E-R. H-A-R-D, Gerhard, yes? He was completely different from me. He was very tall, I was very small. He was 6 foot tall, very sporty, could do enormous willpower, and he came even from the school, which I went to later on, but the school had changed. He went somewhere, he wasn't very good in gymnastics and things like this. He was very important in Germany. So he decided he had to be better, and he ended up to be the best gymnast in the school. And then when he left school, my parents went to see the director, who was very progressive, very nice man, and said, what shall we do with him? And he said, for him, there's only one place. There's an art, a new art gallery, and a gallery, university, which is quite revolutionary, and he would be at home there with, of course, Bauhaus. And my mother went there, it was very expensive, my father was before my father was born, and came full enthusiasm whenever he came home. We visited him one day, and we saw this Bauhaus, which was in a town not far from Berlin, and had extreme modern art. Actually, we didn't realize that it was a pioneer of modern art, which became later on the guiding place for the whole world. And my father brought a picture, a stuck picture to my father, a little picture, and said to whether he liked it, whether he could buy it. And my father asked him, does this man need for money? Or would he have to help him? He said, oh no, he's a very already well known artist. I said, no, that's not for me, it's enough. And this was a man who painted this picture, was called Klee. And many years later in London, I went to the exhibition of Klee, which has become a very famous modern artist, and I saw a picture in the gallery, not the same picture, but a similar picture.
This was Klee, L-E-E.
That's right.
Yes.
And I asked the owner of the gallery how much it was, and it was £50,000. And we could have had it about for the equivalent of £5. So I was very thrilled with my father, because my father was very, very nice to me, considering that I was very young and he was 10 years older. I mean, when he was 18, I was 10, you see. But he always treated me as if I was an adult. I could ask him anything and he would patiently explain it to me. And I found it so thrilling, you know, that I felt this thing, I felt already 10 years older. And he always was amused about me and was a character on his back and so on. It was very, very fascinating for me because it gave my life a totally different dimension. And as long as I knew him, I never had any argument with him, and he was starving in the end and was sent me a birthday present. And that time my mother said to him, she admired him, but she couldn't share his outlook. She felt it was that communism was a utopia. She couldn't, didn't believe that it would ever lead to anything. And he was offered at that time to go with the first student delegation to Germany as a guest of honor to our chef for 4 weeks, you see. And since he paid for it, yes, he went. And this was actually my father, just before my father had committed suicide, he asked the people at the stop agency, let them go, he comes back again, he will be totally disillusioned. So after 6 weeks, he came back again and was like a, I don't know, Muslim person who was going to Mecca. He felt that was the answer. It was fantastic, it was absolutely brilliant. And there became an album congress, and at that time my mother said, listen, he never attended any birthday parties other than from other families who were quite, still quite well off, because he couldn't get it to mix with bourgeois, you see. And if you want to be a communist, a working class, I know that objection, if you feel that you're happy. But then you should really live amongst them, not here with our own flat. See, that's not right. He saw that and moved out. So he was more, he came from visiting us from time to time. So Lemus didn't see him for his own sometimes. And my mother then lived from the money which she got for subletting to Romans. My sister was still in school, I of course was still in school, and she got some support from some organization. But we lived very spartan. And I didn't have, because I didn't have towels, something to play with. I didn't have so many suits or anything like this. I didn't mind that. I was always very busy reading and interesting and listening to people, because I was always terribly keen to find out what was happening, you see.